for February 18th, 2020.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly moves approval of the minutes for February 18th, 2020. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 18th, 2020 are approved. We have Representative Hewitt here today to present his bill about student loan refinancing program eligibility expansion and money appropriated. So welcome to the committee, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and then I do want to add to this that we I will move the bill for House File 583 and to be laid over for further consideration. So this will be very limited testimony today as the bill was given a full hearing last year. So Representative Hewitt, you do have an amendment, and it's in a technical amendment, I understand, to update the dates.
That is correct.
So I will move that A3 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Hewitt, please tell us about your bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. House File 583 does very simple things. It lets the Department of Higher Ed actually reduce some of the standards to borrow to students. As you guys heard in last year's, when we presented last year, we just changed the dates on it. Basically, this will lighten the requirements both possibly for credit and also loan to value.
Okay.
For student loans. I should caveat that this is about student loans, not car loans.
There you go. Thank you for that clarification. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 583? Seeing none, is there any further discussion of House File 583?
Madam Chair, just clarification. It's
to be Representative Cleavorn.
It's to be laid over.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no further questions, I renew my motion that House File 583 be laid over for further consideration. All in favor? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion, and so that was not me saying nay. So I'm just saying that. The motion carries.
Madam Chair, if I could, I do want to give.
Oh, shoot. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. I want to give Representative Pryor credit for this because I maybe hijacked the bill. Okay. So, all right. Thank you, people.
You're the comment. Thank you very much. So, Representative Wolgamott is next with House File 3087, and you get to move your own bill regarding Minnesota State Colleges and University critical operating funding provided. That's, I don't know if that's kind of tongue twister.
So moved.
Okay, so moved. So Representative Wolgamott has moved House File 3087. Be referred to Ways and Means, I believe you meant to say.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So please tell us about your bill, Representative Wolgamott.
Madam Chair, members, it's with a heavy heart that I'm here to tell you that in 2019, the state of Minnesota failed our students. We failed our faculty. We failed to keep tuition low at our state colleges and universities, including two colleges and universities that are very close to my heart, St. Cloud State University and St. Cloud Technical Community College. Madam Chair and members, we can do better, and we need to do better. That's why I'm here today to present to you House File 3087 to stop tuition increases and make the necessary investments to provide a high-quality education for all Minnesotans. This bill, House File 3087, is a joint effort between myself, students, and faculty to secure $54.2 million in supplemental funding. That includes $39.7 million to support our campuses and keep tuition low, as well as $14.5 million for upgrading the integrated statewide record system. This investment will protect students from increased tuition and start to fill the gap created by the higher education budget that we passed last session. If fully funded, this request provides a tuition freeze and protects our campuses from diverting funds from instruction and student needs. Madam Chair, this is important to my community, but it's important to our whole state, and I've got the numbers to back it up. St. Cloud State University and St. Cloud Technical and Community College are vital to the success of my community. These two institutions of higher education support more than 7,000 jobs and create $875 million in economic activity for our region. The high quality education offered in St. Cloud matters even if you don't necessarily, even if you're not a student, or even if you don't, your child isn't a student. It helps everybody because it helps the businesses in St. Cloud develop future workforce, keep our economy, the economy in our region strong. And this has statewide ramifications because state colleges and universities around our state contribute $8 billion to our economy and support more than 67,000 jobs. Members, Madam Chair, without these resources put forward in House File 3087, SESU and SCTCC and our state colleges all across Minnesota have had and will have no choice but to make significant cuts to their academic, co-curricular, and academic programming. Madam Chair and members, you don't have to just take my word for it. I have some folks who are prepared to testify today to underscore to you the importance and urgency to pass House File 3087.
Thank you very much. And I believe our first testifier is Jonathan Bowen. Nope, okay. Let's see if the next one is Mark Grant. Nope. Okay, how about Tracy Rahim? Okay, well, we're clipping right along today. Okay, Thomas Anderson from Students United. Okay, Hamisha Alakamune. Okay.
Awesome.
Yay, thank you. Appreciate you being here today, and welcome to our committee. If you could state your name and your affiliation, that would be great.
Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, Representative Wolgamont. My name is Hamisha Alkamune, and I'm the student body president at Metropolitan State University. I also serve on the board of directors for Students United, the official representative voice for all Minnesota State University students. School was never an easy decision for me. As a high school dropout, I had many barriers to overcome. As a single mom, I had my children to worry about. As a person struggling with homelessness, I had very few options. On February 28th of 2016, I left an abusive relationship. I had my 2-year-old daughter and was pregnant with my second child. We had nowhere to go, but it was time to leave, so we spent the entire month of March living in my Prius in the parking lot of Walmart South in Rochester, Minnesota. At that time, I knew that the only way out of that life was to go to school. So I worked to earn my GED from Hawthorne Academy. During this time, I was also working 60 hours a week and saving for an apartment. By the end of March, I had a security deposit and first month spent together and had signed a lease. I had also earned my GED. I knew I couldn't afford a university, so I started my educational journey at a community college. Once I had exhausted all the credits that I could possibly take there, I transferred to Metropolitan State University here in St. Paul. My main concern was tuition costs, and Metro was the most affordable of my options. Today, I'm speaking to you as a senior graduating in May with a bachelor's degree in psychology and a 3.5 GPA. I overcame my barriers, right? But I think I have inherited a whole new set of barriers. My current student loan balance is $46,567.27. The biggest problem that I see with my situation is that this is not unique. And to continue increasing this financial burden on students who are often barely getting by as it is not okay. My peers and I are supporting Minnesota State's supplemental budget request, and we are grateful to Representative Wolgamont for introducing the bill. As all of you are already aware, the cost of higher education is skyrocketing, while state funding has stagnated since the recession. Even with the strong efforts of the allies in this room, me and my peers have been dealt yet another tuition increase. This year, tuition went up by 3% at 6 of the 7 Minnesota State universities, with the exception being St. Cloud, where it went up by 4.2%. These numbers are important, but they are more than just numbers. They are impacting real people, like me, who are trying to do everything right. We are attending our classes, engaging in our communities, and speaking to our representatives. We are choosing schools based on affordability and working multiple jobs to support ourselves and sometimes support our dependents as well. A freeze on tuition and funding for NextGen would provide much needed relief from this demoralizing cycle. And the consequences of these continued tuition increases and loss of critical programming cannot be overstated. Another tuition hike is another student dropping out. It's another year of skipping meals. It's a third or fourth job. It's a choice between smart financial management and a college degree. Thank you all for your time and your support.
And thank you for your testimony and for sharing your story. And congratulations on your success and best wishes in your career.
Thank you.
We are going to move on to our next testifier, which is Matt Gutch from Leadman. Is he here? No. Okay. And then we have Abala Abala from Leadman. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and your affiliation.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Obala Obala, and I am the president of Leadman. Chair Benatti, member of House of Higher Education Committee, thank you for providing me this opportunity to testify before you today. While this is not the first time I have testified with this committee, this is my first testimony as a United States citizen. After having received my citizenship in December, receiving my citizenship is part of my American dream come true. Over the 3 years that I have been serving with Leadman, I have talked with thousands of students from across our great state. I can tell you for firsthand that Minnesota community and technical college students outside in this room are struggling to pay for their education, to afford food, to pay their rent, and support their family. Most of us are trying to balance our academic success while working multiple jobs to pay for school and our bills. Students are putting in the work to pursue and pay for their education, but many are still falling short due to the high cost of college. In 2013, I came to the United States after spending 10 years in a refugee camp in Kenya. When I started my college, I thought I wouldn't need to worry about the high tuition and textbook costs because I was told financial aid would cover everything. Once my FAFSA was provided, though I found out that I did not have enough financial aid to help cover my tuition and my textbook. Because of this, I had to find a second job to afford the costs of college and pay for an apartment. Working two jobs and going to school full time, I still did not have enough money to pay for food and other basic necessities, and found it difficult to focus on my academic and completing my degree. I was lucky to find support on my campus and in my community, but many students do not have the support they need. As a student leader on my campus, I was determined to make sure that future students would not face this obstacle, and that took me down a path to become a Leadman president. I am here before you today as a student who has faced the barrier and that so many of our students are facing now. And it is why I am asking you to support this bill. Without this funding, our students will face a further increase in tuition, and that will only make college more unaffordable, especially for those who are already struggling the most. Yesterday, over 100 community and technical college students traveled from all across the state to our beautiful capital to talk with you and other legislators. Many of them shared their story with you about the hardship they face in trying to complete their degree. As you move forward in this session, please keep those stories in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on becoming a citizen, and thank you for your leadership in our state.
Thank you.
Okay, so Diana Holmes, would you like to testify? And then Pat Benner will be on deck, or together, however you decide. We can pull up another chair if you would like.
Hello, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and affiliation and provide your testimony, please. Okay.
My name is Diana Holmes, and I work at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall, Minnesota. We are a gem of a university in the prairie on the southwest corner. We also serve the region, and we're proud to do so. I am an office administrative specialist senior, and I work in fine arts and communication. I also serve as an AFSCME member and president of our local. And I would like to explain the impact of the funding that we are requesting as I am an end user of the outdated technology. The ISRS is a technology that we're using across the system, and it impacts communication that we have across campus in financial aid, registrar's office, admissions, the business office, the academic departments. It also affects our students to make sure that whenever they have communication with any one of the offices, we know who they are and what their needs are, and we try and serve them as well as we possibly can. The infrastructure is aging, and with it, it has a lot of inefficiencies. So as an end user, what I understand about ISR is we have the main structure, and then we have several platforms and applications that the system office pieces together so that we can work and do our job. It's our tool. It's what I do to communicate to students, to communicate with faculty, to communicate with the community. When I am working with faculty to procure a piece of equipment or maybe a guest artist, we have to go through a marketplace system, and to register them as a vendor, they need to go through three platforms. And to try and explain to a vendor how to register is a very cumbersome process, and it's not very easy. So then when we finally get them in the system and it's time to pay an invoice, we have account clerks that need to process this invoice using two applications. Neither one speak to the other. So that's what I mean by inefficiency. It's very inefficient to process a payment. So what I touch on a day-to-day basis under ISRS includes applications such as Marketplace for purchasing, then a separate web-based accounting package to reconcile budgets and records of transactions that I've processed either as a purchase order or as an invoice. Also, student records. When a student changes their major or changes their advisor, I have to go in and touch that record as well. And that's also a different, that is the actual ISRS. That's the baseline product. Then when we enter courses for the following semester, I'm working with a different curriculum management package as well. And then there's also some of the student issues, such as advising, and to make sure that they graduate on time, we have to reference their DARS. All of these applications are all different, and the next gen system will bring us current, will update the technology so it's much more efficient, and we're not constantly having to learn a new package. And right now, that's what we're doing under the existing technology. We also have concerns that the Mint State, the schools within the Mint State system will need to reprioritize funding if we can't get adequate funding to cover it. And so reprioritize could mean several things. It could mean that we lay off staff and reduce services. It could mean that we keep staff and decrease student services, or we could ask you for funding and support. And that is what I'm here to do today, is to ask for your funding and support. This bill affects every staff member on every Minnesota State College and University, and we are excited at the prospect of finally working with the usable system so we can best serve our students that attend all of our colleges in the state. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing my testimony, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for carrying this bill. I urge your support for passing House File 3087. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Holmes.
Yep.
Mr. Bender, would you like to provide testimony? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wished to testify on House File 3087. Welcome to the committee, Jonathan Bone and Mark Grand. If you could please state your name for the record and affiliation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jonathan Bone. I represent the InterFAC, the organization. Sorry about the confusion before. We just wanted to ensure the students had an opportunity to go first. I represent the InterFAC, the organization. We have approximately 4,000 professors, counselors, coaches, and librarians at all the seven state universities. There's nothing that I can add that the wonderful testimony of our students didn't already say, and I just wanted to thank them, first of all, for their advocacy. Without leaders like them, the state would be in a much worse place. We are dedicated to working with the students, with Representative Wolgamott, and with the House, the Senate, and the governor to secure this funding. As you've heard, it's necessary to the success of our students and our ability to provide a world-class education.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Grant.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Grant. I'm a 20-year communication instructor at Dakota County Technical College, and I currently direct the governmental relations work for Minnesota State College faculty. We are the organization that represents about 4,200 two-year college faculty across the state. As Jonathan said, we did want the students a chance to go first simply because it makes my work very, very light. I can just say ditto. Watching students who have gone through this system speak so eloquently about their educational journey and their struggles makes me increasingly proud every day of the work that our faculty are doing all across the state. So I certainly couldn't add anything that they didn't already cover. I just greatly appreciate Representative Wolgamott's work on this, his foresight, his advocacy for not only the colleges in his district and the deep connection that he feels with his students, but this work will affect and this funding will affect the work that happens in every corner of the state on all 39 Minnesota State College campuses and seven universities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I'd like to move to the members. Is there any further discussion on House File 3087? We have Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the student that brought up the example of the difficulties and hardship. I fully sympathize with what have and students are going through. I worked three part-time jobs while going to school, and for a portion, I lived out of my car. And back then I had the advantage of you wrote a check to fill your gas tank. It took 5 days for it to clear, so then my paychecks could be in the bank, that stuff happens like that now. So it is just tough and difficult. I understand what this bill is working to do. It'd be nice to understand some of the cost drivers. About a decade ago, I stopped at it was in Rochester where the faculty were meeting, and they were talking about, and someone came out and talked to me afterwards and said, you know, we'd like to know where all the increases are coming from, because it's not going to our salary increases. And so it'd be nice for us in the committee to see over the last one or two decades that percentage breakouts. I know we've had some discussion about administrative costs and some of the other cost drivers, to the IT issues. I just wanted to confirm that Minit and MNET were being utilized, the Minnesota Enterprise Network, and how we're leveraging the state to help all the different sites, and you know, the feedback about the issues, so that when they develop and implement, that all the campuses get to be in the alpha and the beta testing, so that when it rolls out, it's seamless and you don't have the headaches to the students or damage to the data. Because you're asking for this money, but all the buckets that money is going to our key areas, and I'm just shocked that we don't have the compatibility. And hopefully when you migrate, you go to a cloud system and server and et cetera, so that you can have that uniformity. But the bill, if you can have information to the committee more broken out on some of the specifics and the longer range ones that I think we're going to have to pay over the coming years, and can help monitor and make sure that everything's going well, so that in 2 years you don't come back and say something broke. Let's be proactive and head it off. So good luck. Minscu and the different universities have been really good at looking at cost containment, but let's have the discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Palm.
Thank you.
I didn't hear a question on that. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just wanted to get a handle on, maybe somebody could refresh us, on Next Gen and the costs associated with that. I mean, I have constituents who have had tremendous problems because it's such an antiquated system and it's ridiculously old. But now, so $37 million was in the bill that passed in 2019 was directed at the ISRS. Now another $14 million, so for a total of whatever $51 million. Is that it, or what's the total expected cost? And if we could find out where does the buck stop in terms of having that this system implement correctly? Who is answering and checking all the questions and making sure it's going to work? We've kind of seen where some of those things, aren't managed, I guess, particularly well.
Representative Wolgamott, I was going to turn to Mr. Savory here to get that answered. Would that be okay with you?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I also have some folks from the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system who can help answer those questions as well.
Thank you. Mr. Savory, as far as answering about the money for last year?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, the bill that passed the legislature and eventually was signed by the governor contained $8 million in each fiscal year, so a total of $16 million for the biennium designated for ISRS. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, that was $8 million in total for ISRS. Oh, okay.
Madam Chair and
Representative Runbeck.
Council, do we have a total projected cost for the final completed system?
Yeah, Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, I think it would be better if you hear from the agency or from Minn State about the projected cost.
Okay, we're having someone come down from Minnesota State. I think they'd probably be able to answer that question fairly quickly.
Sure.
I could give you a number, but it's better to come from you guys. Or you all, I should say.
Steve Ernest, System Director for Financial Planning and Analysis.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Mr. Savory said, there was $4 million per year in the bill last year. And the total scoped project is a $150 million project, as we're envisioning it now. We are, as the Chancellor told the committee yesterday, still in the RFP process and trying to figure out all the ins and outs of how it will come together. The $150 million number is our guide right now.
Okay.
Does that
right.
answer the question?
And Representative
Chair, I guess then, so the direction for the rollout of this and the development and rollout is coming then in your office or handled by your office, sir?
Okay.
Madam Chair?
About Mr. Ernesto. Is it Ernesto? Did I get it
Ernest.
Right? Okay. Curtis.
Ernest.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I was getting more creative.
Representative Rundeck, the system office is coordinating because it is for the whole system, and our colleges and universities have been contributing towards our saving up some money for this to have a plan in place to pay for this once we see what all it will cost and how long it will take to do. There are phases involved, and the board is overseeing it. The board is responsible for the success of it. We have lots of safeguards in place. Our IT staff could talk about some of those a little more if you'd like to hear that.
This wouldn't probably be appropriate today. I mean, it seems like it could be a longer discussion, and I would encourage us to maybe schedule some time for that and just hear, you know, how it's being planned and more of the steps involved.
Okay, well, we'll take note to that and see if we can fit something like that in. Okay, and Representative Lucero, and what I do want to say is we do have a meeting room scheduled for 6:30 tonight if we would like to stay tonight, and we can, the time allotted for this hearing has passed, and that's fine. I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware of our time constraints today for moving into tonight. So Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to echo what Representative Rumbeck was bringing up, in that as a former member of the Transportation Committee, you know, we've spent over $100 million on a system for the DVS that was used, or I should say was scrapped, better way to put it. And so and that was originally projected to cost, I think, right around the $50 million mark. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm hearing a projection in the neighborhood of $150 million, well, I don't want that to balloon into $300 million, doubling as the DVS system did, so the MNLARS system. So learning from our experience, right, having cost taxpayers over $100 million, we definitely want to know who's going to be accountable, where does the buck stop, what assurances and guideposts can we have along the path of development, right, and all those series of questions to prevent what happened in the past. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. I understand that the legislature gave the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges about the same amount, about $80 million in the last budget. And it was less than what you asked for. But this request is stating that the purpose of the request is to hold tuition down. At the same time, the legislature required the system to keep tuition increases no more than 3%. So I guess my bigger question is, how have you been able to do that? And what's your alternative if you don't receive this supplemental funding?
Okay, Mr. Ernest.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the the colleges and universities in the system are all in a slightly different situation. So of the two sides of their funding, their tuition stays locally, and then they get a portion of the state side of the funding based on what's going on with their needs, and there are some complex formulas that determine that, put that money towards the needs, and it rewards efficiencies and things like that. So some colleges have had larger decreases in enrollment and have had more challenges with reallocating their funding and cutting certain costs, and others haven't had as much. But in general, the 3% across both sides of the funding stream doesn't cover doing everything the same as we've done it before. So everyone is challenged with some kind of efficient, looking for efficiencies, potentially cutting different things to help their budget just get through. Some have some savings that they've dipped into. They can't do too much of that. They need to have some of those for a rainy day. That's generally what they keep, which is what they need for a rainy day, as guided by the Higher Education Commission's guidelines. So what the board has said is, if this funding comes through as requested, they would not entertain requests from the colleges and universities to increase their undergraduate tuition again this year, even though, as you pointed out, the law sets a 3% cap on that.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up, okay, President Lehman?
Yes, Madam Chair, if I could, because I'm not clear on that. I think I heard what you said is that if you get the supplemental funding, you will not increase tuition next year. Is that what you said?
Mr. Ernest.
Madam Chair and Representative, that is what the board has said.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Franson.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. If I recall, there was a motion to move this bill to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Let me verify what it is to be sure. And it is to, hold on a second, I'm getting it. It is to move it to Ways and Means, yep.
So my question is then to you is, why aren't we moving it over, or what's the plan? What do you foresee? Is this going to the floor on a separate vote, or?
Chair Carlson, he will be making that decision where it goes once it hits his committee.
Okay.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, would you like to do some wrap-up remarks, Mr. Wolgemut? I mean, Representative Wolgemut.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. We have a really important opportunity to get this right. We have the chance to get this right for our students, to get this right for our faculty, to get this right for our local economies, and to get this right for Minnesotans. Madam Chair, members, let's send House File 3087 to Ways and Means and be one step closer to giving all Minnesotans access to the quality, affordable higher education that they deserve. Thank you.
Okay, and so Representative Wolgemut, do you renew your motion to refer House File? Why don't you renew your motion?
I renew my motion to send House File 3087 to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. So now I'm going to hand over the gavel to Vice Chair Pryor. And we have two bills left to go, and we were going to cover those in 45 minutes. So hopefully we'll be able to gain some time so we won't be returning tonight. And I'll move to the testifier stations.
Next, we have
So she's talking to the microphone. Thank you. Next, we have House File 3392. Chair Bernardi, would you like to move your bill?
Vice Chair Pryor. I'd like to move House File 3392 to be laid over for further consideration.
Okay.
And there is, oh, sorry.
And thank you, Chair Bernardi. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I would like to move a one amendment to put in the form that we would like.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
You were good.
There we go. Thank you. Ask you. All right. Chair Bernardi, would you please tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the bill from the Office of Higher Education that I am carrying, and I brought Nikki Oliver with us today, and she's going to walk us through the bill.
Thank you. Ms. Oliver, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Manager of Grants and Government Relations for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And I will walk through the bill.
Yeah. Please proceed.
So Section 1 is amending the campus sexual assault report that our office publishes annually. We retrieve data from each institution. What we're doing here is defining incident. To clarify, this has been vetted with all the Title IX coordinators. Section 2 is clarifying the Office of Higher Education's name. This was recommended to us by the Attorney General's office as we go through our underwriting process for our self-loan bonds. So for this change, we're just clarifying that we're also known as the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Section 3 is updating the Student Advisory Council language. Currently, the Minnesota Career College Association no longer exists, so we're striking that language. And we're also adding tribal college student representation to the advisory council. Section 4 is we're creating a tribal nations education committee parity for higher education, similar to what K-12 already has. Section 5 is directing our office and the Minnesota Department of Education to work with stakeholders in creating an annual free application for federal student aid completion goal. Section 6 is prohibiting the suspension or withdrawal of students from classes due to an unpaid balance or arrearage on institutional loans after the school's 100% refund policy. This is a consumer protection piece. We have experienced students being kicked out of their courses after that 100% refund deadline. So this is strengthening that schools are prohibited from doing that. The student is still obligated to pay the institution, but the school has to allow the student to also complete their coursework. Section 7 amends the definition for eligible schools for the post-secondary child care grant program. Several years ago, the legislature added that professional and graduate students could now participate in receiving the child care grant. So this language is adding that those professional only and graduate only schools could also be participating institutions in providing that grant. Section 8 is updating the teacher candidate grant. A couple years ago, Pelsby was assigned duties that were originally the Department of Education when they were created. The reviser went through several statutes and changed the Department of Education to Pelsby, the Professional Education Licensing and Standards Board. I think because this was in the higher education statute, this was an oversight, so we're fixing that here. Section 9 is related to our Student Education Loan Fund, so the state's financial, our, the state loan program for attending post-secondary institutions. So what we're doing here is currently we have flexibility to set the maximums for students attending four-year institutions. So here we're creating, duplicating that language for the 2 years. Section 10 is related to the teacher shortage loan forgiveness program. When the program was created, a licensed teacher was tier 3 or higher. So we're just clarifying that for the purposes of this program that a licensed teacher is tier 3 or higher. We know that currently all tiers are considered licensed and the funding is restricted. There's limited funding for this program. So we're just keeping with the intent of the program. Section 11 is once again changing Commissioner of Education to Professional Education Licensing Standards Board and also allowing for our office to work with Pelsby in establishing, in getting that information for what the shortage areas are for the purposes of our program so we can put out the application earlier. This was in consultation with all the coalitions, Ed Minnesota, and Pelsby as well, for this specific program itself. Section 12 amends the large animal veterinarian loan forgiveness program. Currently, there's a five, we can only give out awards to five individuals, and if the the selection committee selects an individual that does not need the maximum amount of money, we are not allowed to award that to a sixth individual. So this is eliminating that five person maximum. Section 13, this is actually, so section 13 and section 19 are, this is what was actually amended out. So skip over that. Section 14 is to limit conditional registration approval for new schools. So this is just saying any outside schools that want to operate in Minnesota must already be accredited. This is actually putting what is in practice, having it reflected in statute. Section 15 and Section 21 makes explicit that schools being licensed and registered with our office must also be in compliance with other state and federal laws. Section 16 through 18 and also sections 22 through 24. These are, this is clarifying what an exempt status of a religious program is. So there are seminary schools and schools that do provide seminary programs. We don't regulate that. So what we're doing in this is clarifying that. In section 20, this is updating and modernizing the refund policy. So this is, we're striking the word written because we allow for other ways for students to withdraw from institutions, and so does the Fed. So this is actually being reflective of what the Feds currently do as well. Section 25. It mandates the Office of Higher Education will produce a race and ethnicity data collection report. This is in working with stakeholders. We know Minnesota State is currently in the process of doing that. University of Minnesota has something currently, but we want this to be statewide, and we want to make sure we're doing it right. So this legislation is prompting us to work with stakeholders to develop a way to do this reporting. Section 26 is the repealer, I believe, right? So section, the repealer, so we're repealing an obsolete survey. The National Accreditation, National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnership used to require a survey of the institutions who provide concurrent enrollment They eliminated that survey in 2018, I believe, so we're just striking that language. We're working offline with MDE and our office to see how we have existing resources and how we can provide more useful information and collect in replace of this survey. Madam Chair, if you want to, I don't know if there's any questions for this article, but I can move to Article 2 if you'd like.
Yeah. Any questions at this point? Clarifying questions? Okay, great. Please proceed. Can I call Robert here?
29 plan. Madam Chair, I'd like to bring Robert Helgeson up here. He's our 529 plan manager, and everything in Article 2 is related to the 529 plan.
Thank you, Mr. Helgeson. If you can identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Robert Helgeson. I'm the audit manager for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and one of my duties is also the primary contact and contract manager for the Minnesota College Savings Plan.
So I can go by section, or I know we're limited on time, or I can just give a summary of what the changes are. And if there's questions, we can answer those if you'd like.
All right. That sounds like a good plan. Thank you. Great.
So a few years ago, the feds added that K-12 expenses can be used for the 529 savings plan. And more recently, in December of last year, they also added that expenses for apprenticeships and the payment of student loans could be allowable expenses. So we're updating our state statutes related to the 529 plan to reflect those allowances. This statute is actually very old, so there's also a few updated, some things that are we're updating based on current practices of the industry and some clarifying changes. For example, there's a technical change that changes the word 10 to the number 10, things like that. More policy related, there's the matching grant program for the 529 plan that ended quite a few years ago. 10 years ago. And we know that there has been some burden on the account owners in the current way the law is written. They have to take a proportionate amount of the matching funds and the funds that they put in, and that's been burdensome, and Robert can explain more about that, but what we're doing here is allowing for those individuals to withdraw their entire matching funds. We do pay a vendor to manage those accounts, and at some point they might be managing a $10 account because they have to pull out proportionate amounts. So I don't know if you want me to go into detail there or no.
Any questions on that portion of it?
All right. That's pretty much so. Most of this is updating the language to reflect those new allowances and also keeping the intent of the program as well, and removing some of those barriers for account owners. And this comes from the vendor and industry practices and what other states have been doing. I don't have anything else to add unless there's specific questions.
All right. Any question from members at this point? And is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify? Okay. Seeing none, Chair Bernardi, would you like to renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion for House File 3392 to be laid over for further consideration.
Okay. All in favor?
As amended.
Thank you very much, Representative Cleavorn. Yes. As amended.
As amended. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion carries.
Thank you.
Okay, before we proceed to the next bill, there's someone I would like to introduce today. I believe it's Alex. And I think I might get it right. Baker Bender?
That is correct.
Welcome to the committee. He will be our page this year.
Well,
yeah, thank you. Wonderful. So we're waiting for Representative Cagle to come. So, Alex, I didn't prepare you for this, but one of the things, if you would come to the testifier stand, please. One of the things, and if we have time, I'll ask our new committee CLA this as well, but if we've shared with each other, if you can do it like in 30 seconds, like how higher education or post-secondary education has impacted your life. And I could make Eric do it first if you would like, but you decide. If you could share that with us, that would be great.
No, I'm absolutely fine going ahead.
Go ahead.
So
state your name for the record.
So my name is Alex Baker Bender. I'm actually a recent graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison with a Bachelor of Science in Biology. I took a couple years off and kind of helped me realign what my original plans were. I was originally interested in going into medicine. Took a couple years off during my schooling. So during one of those years, I worked as a CNA, actually down in Northfield for the Northfield Retirement Community. Because I'm originally from Lonsdale, Minnesota. In that time off, I kind of reassessed what my outlook was, originally thinking med school, but with that and kind of my past experiences, I found out I'm actually more interested in healthcare policy rather than healthcare practice. And so that's part of the thing that prompted me to go into the public sector, starting as a page. But then I just only had two classes left before getting my degree, so I decided to just kind of buckle down and get that through. And I'm currently working now. But biding my time, and I eventually want to get into the Humphrey School. That would be my ideal goal because it's a great public administration, public policy school. So, yeah, that's
okay,
kind of my.
Thank you, Alex, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have our new committee legislative assistant that can share how education has impacted or changed his or his family's life. We'll add that too.
Thanks, Chair Bernardi. Again, Eric Peterson, Committee Legislative Assistant. I attended St. Cloud State University as a Husky. Actually, 7 years ago, was sitting at that testifying stand talking to the Higher Education Committee when Chair Pulowski had the gavel. So it's interesting to be in this room full circle 7 years later. But my dad was a military veteran, and my mom only went to a two-year technical college. So I was the first in my family to go to a four-year institution. So that has impacted my life. My younger brother went to the University of Minnesota, so we both graduated in 4 years and are hoping to get rid of some of the student loan debt. So in full circle, I started as a teaching major and got into politics, and here we are. So
excellent. Well, thank you very much. And just perfect timing, great staff members. We have Representative Cagle here to come before our committee with her bill, which is House File 3089. So I will move the bill, House File 3089, to be laid over for further consideration. Welcome to the committee, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Chance
to catch your breath.
Missed the testimony.
Right, exactly. You're probably used to chasing around Clara, so you probably can do that. And we also have some testifiers with your bill today, as I understand. So if you could please explain your bill to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Sorry, I'm out of breath. I ran over here from my liver committee at the Capitol, so try to get here as quick as possible. So what House File 3089 would do is it would appropriate $240,000 to the Office of Higher Education to grant to Hennepin County Medical Center to support for physicians enrolled in an addiction medicine special fellowship program. And one of the reasons that this bill is important to me is because, as many of you know, my brother had gone through the opioid crisis, and addiction medicine specialist saved his life. Our family is one that had a happy outcome Unfortunately, a lot of families don't have the same outcomes, and my brother's been sober for over 4 years and is now working in the recovery field. And so we feel so fortunate that that was the outcome for our family. And I've also been tasked, appointed to the Opioid Epidemic Response Task Force. And so through that work, I've gotten to know a lot of these really caring addiction medicine specialists. And so I will just let them speak for themselves.
Okay, thank you. We have Dr. Charlie Kesnikoff. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record and share us your testimony. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Charles Resnikoff. I'm an addiction medicine doctor at Hennepin County Medical Center and in Rice County, and I'm an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairwoman Barnardi, for hearing this bill, and thank you, Representative Cagle, for this bill, and also Representative Nornes for past support of the Addiction Medicine Fellowship. So I graduated from the University of Minnesota Addiction Medicine Fellowship in 2008. 2008 was the tail end of the prior methamphetamine epidemic and was in the middle of an opioid epidemic. So I got straight to work. Since then, I've been at Hennepin County Medical Center in downtown Minneapolis, and also, incidentally, in Lonsdale, Minnesota, and treating addictions in a clinic in Rice County. I currently treat almost 1,000 people with opioid use disorder, with addictions, mostly opioid use disorder, many of whom are back to life as normal, and you might not even recognize that they're in recovery. It's incredible work. I also help supervise addiction medicine fellows at Hennepin County Medical Center, where they're part-time. They're part-time there at Hennepin County Medical Center, part-time there at the University of Minnesota. And some of the money from this bill would go to HCMC. I also teach addiction medicine to practicing primary care doctors and at the University of Minnesota Medical School. In fact, next week I'm teaching a communication workshop to 150 medical students on how to speak to people with addiction. And anyone, if you're interested, you're welcome to join and reach out to me and I'll arrange it. I know you all are really busy right now, but it should be an exciting event. But I'm not saying all this about myself because I am unique. I'm only one of many fellows, and the fellows that graduated from our University of Minnesota program are doing this amazing range of things around the state. It's really incredible. And it's amazing to think that graduates from the Addiction Fellowship program are not just addiction doctors. They're addiction teachers, because there's so much misunderstanding in our community about what addiction is and what it means. So they're doctors and they're teachers. And it's an amazing group of graduates. Addiction medicine as a field is in an interesting place right now. I mean, obviously, there's an opioid epidemic happening. There's an under-recognized methamphetamine epidemic happening. There are synthetic drugs coming from China. There's vaping-associated lung injuries, you know, in children vaping cannabis, not to mention tobacco and alcohol. 10% of Minnesotans are affected by alcoholism or drug addiction. We have treatments for many of these problems, and we're developing new knowledge and treatments every year. So addiction medicine is this fast-changing, cutting-edge field. A recent study showed that giving opioid addiction treatments saves $78,000 per year to Medicaid patients. Per patient, so $78,000 per patient per year for Medicaid. Another study showed those same treatments cut the risk of death in half from opioid overdose. And yet, only 30% of Minnesotans get those treatments. So this bill would help fix that, would help get those treatments, save the money, save those lives. Addiction Medicine Fellowship is now ACGME recognized. And so what that means is that it could be federally funded. However, the federal government recognized the ACGME status but did not provide any funding and did not expand any funding. So what that means is that the fellowship for now is the future of the fellowship is uncertain. And this is exactly the time where we need addiction doctors the most. And this is the only addiction medicine fellowship in the state. Every year, we the fellowship, gets better and better applicants to our program. One of them's here today. The fellowship graduates bright, passionate, community-involved doctors, and they treat the most vulnerable Minnesotans. So this bill would show Minnesotans' commitment to staying at the front of the pack nationally for healthcare. It will, this bill will help us fight the current drug epidemics and also the future epidemics, whichever, whenever they emerge. And I, you know, when I, speaking to you, I realize that we're asking something special from you. We're asking for protected funding for a training program. But we're doing it because it's the only way to guarantee that Minnesota builds this addiction medicine workforce that we need. And so I would just ask you to consider this an investment in the health of our state, but also an investment in the education of the next generation of clinicians. So thank you very much for your time, and I hope you consider supporting the bill.
Thank you. And we have Dr. Sheila Specker from with the University of Minnesota to provide testimony. And I just want to share, we want to hear your testimony, and I know that you've been formed to testify about 1 to 3 minutes, and we have 5 minutes left, so I think we'll be able to do it, but I just wanted to let our testifier know what the parameters of our committee are right now. Thank you. We finish at 3:45, but we could stay late if we needed to. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sheila Specker, and I am a physician and addiction medicine and addiction psychiatrist at the University of Minnesota and have been there for probably about 20 years. I'm here in my role today as the program director for our addiction medicine fellowship. And I want to thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you, Representative Cagle, for inviting me to come and testify. I also am a family physician, and this is how I became interested in addiction medicine, when I saw my patients struggling with addiction and feeling very ill-equipped to manage their illness. So I came to the University of Minnesota to do a fellowship in addiction medicine, so I too am a graduate. I have become very passionate in teaching addiction, as does Dr. Reznikoff, to students, residents, faculty, as well as fellows. As Dr. Reznikoff stated, that there's a dire need for more addiction physicians, as evidenced by the opioid crisis, and that we only have half of the counties in Minnesota have a physician who's waivered to prescribe a highly effective medication, which is Suboxone. So we have not reached out very effectively into those communities. I also wanted to point out that the situation is even more dire in certain communities. Racial disparities are extremely marked in Minnesota, more so than even in other states. The statistics that I saw were that Native American Minnesotans were 5 times as likely to die from a drug overdose than were whites, and that we were the worst state in the United States with regard to that. And in 2017, the data even looked worse. So these are alarming numbers, and we as a fellowship are responding to that in terms of establishing partnerships in the community with the Native American Community Center, with Cook Clinic Community University Healthcare Center, which treats and serves Native Americans and other underrepresented populations. As Dr. Reznikoff said, interest in the fellowship has really mushroomed over the past several years. Typically, we train 1 to 2, and we have about 8 applications this past year. I have committed 3 persons to start. Over the years, we probably treated about 60 physicians from many different specialties, primary care, psychiatry, and surgery. Our impact, I think, is much greater than simply training 1 or 2 physicians in terms of taking leadership roles in the community. And this is what we're training our fellows to, as evidenced by our fellow who is here today. We're working hard to expand the workforce. I wanted to say what it is that we've done. And we're not just coming here to ask money, because we have no other choice. Sustainability is key. And we have acquired the national accreditation, which is required for funding. And as Dr. Reznikoff stated, that we are not able to access it. There are not enough funds to train residents, much less fellows. So residents have the priority. We have worked with the VA to procure a 0.7 position from the federal government. And today, I'm just finishing writing a grant. It's a federal grant, a HRSA grant, in order to expand the workforce and provide care in underserved areas. This past few weeks, we've obtained approval from our accrediting agency, which is the ACGME, to expand our fellowship to 3 this coming year, and 4 is the plan in the future. We can't do this without having predictable funds, and having sustainable funds is the key. In short, there's a huge need for more addiction physicians, and we are in a good position to do so if we have the funding to provide that. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay, and I do need to make a correction. I'm glad you finished your full testimony. That's very good. I was managing till 3:45, and we actually have till 4 for our committee. So Representative Gomez has a question.
I more just wanted to make a comment. I think I'm really grateful to Representative Cagle for all your work on this in this area. You know, I think like a lot of people in Minnesota, I have somebody who's very, very close to me who's, you know, actively using opiates, and it's just like, it's such a difficult and intense kind of liminal space to occupy, right? Like where the possibility, the kind of looming possibility and likelihood of somebody who you love so dearly dying at any moment is just really a high level of just stress and uncertainty to live with. And so, you know, I know it's kind of like, you know, the feeling like when she's like, she's in treatment right now, she and was in jail a couple months ago, and it's like, even her being in jail, it's like this kind of relief of like, oh, maybe she's less likely to die there today, right? And I guess something in Ms. Specker's, I don't know if you're a doctor.
Yes.
Dr. Specker, excuse me. Something in your testimony I just was really surprising to me. The fact that of our 87 counties, half of them do not have a provider who has a waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. That's just so alarming. So, this supports 4 additional professionals, right? But like, we need 10 times that at least. And so I guess I just, for people who aren't familiar, you know, this is buprenorphine or Suboxone saves people's lives. It keeps the loved ones of Minnesotans alive. And so I guess I'm just, I was surprised by that. And I know that, you know, the clinics that you talked about, the Native American Community Clinic and COOC, are on the other side of my district. So my district is also very impacted by this issue. We have a large, you know, Native American population that's really disproportionately suffering from this. But people in my community can get Suboxone. And so, you know, there are a lot of things like that we talk about across the state in terms of like disparities between the kind of urban and rural communities. And so this is something that I guess, you know, like my colleagues from Greater Minnesota, I would hope that you're really pushing for and supporting this program, because you know, getting people who are committed to having the waiver to prescribe Suboxone across the state would just the more that we can do for it, like the better, the more lives will be saved. So thank you so much for your work, and thanks, Representative Cagle, and all of you.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Cagle.
Being on the opioid epidemic response task force, it's always such a mouthful when I say that. But, you know, there's so many issues that we have looked at, and one of them is the waivered providers and the lack of addiction medicine specialists. And so this was just one of those things that when I heard about this program and the funding running out, that, you know, could make an impact quickly and right away. And so there's more to come.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the nonpartisan House research brief, and this is a question for council, I see there's a note on the background that the 2016 omnibus supplemental bill set up some funding, $210,000, for a similar grant program. My question is, was that specifically for HCMC? And if not, if we could get information about the grant awardees for that funding.
Mr. Williams.
Chair and Representative Bean, I believe that funding was just generally for a grant program at the Office of Higher Education that had almost identical parameters to what's established in this bill here. I'm not familiar with where that grant was awarded through that Office of Higher Education program, so maybe the one of the testifiers at the office could speak to that.
Okay, and Dr. Specker can testify to that, it looks like.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. There was previous funding that was correct, and that was to support the fellowship, the Addiction Medicine Fellowship. The end of that funding is this year. So we are looking towards the future, as well as in pursuing all avenues, including the opioid task force money, which is earmarked for other things as well. One other comment I would just make with reference to the rural Minnesota is one of the faculty who is also a fellow, former fellow at Hennepin Healthcare received funding for Project Echo. So Project Echo is a telementoring for rural Minnesota in Suboxone. It can also be in other areas of addiction. So that was funded by the legislature. I believe that was last year.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to be clear, following up Drs. Specker, did that were all of those grant awardees at HCMC, or were some of them at other facilities?
Dr. Specker. Madam Chair and Representative. The fellowship has three main sites. One is Hennepin, one is the VA, and one is the university. So our fellows rotate between those three sites.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Seeing, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since we've got an expert on the subject, recently I heard that the life expectancy went up because overdose deaths went down, because it's a big contributor. Are there programs, trainings, or procedures or policies in other states that made major contributions to the decrease in overdose deaths that we should be looking at implementing, adopting, or including in some of our training programs?
Representative Specker. I mean, Dr. Specker.
I don't know if that's a promotion or demotion.
I could probably, I think we could all let her know that, what it is.
Some deaths from overdose have gone down. On the other hand, deaths from the synthetics have gone up or continued to go up. And so we need to address that very aggressively, not solely partly with medicine, but partly with public policy and making Narcan available. So I think there's many facets to it. But we're still on the rise in terms of the synthetic opioids for deaths.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm realizing I don't know exactly what fellowship means. I mean, so could you describe and how the internship or residency flows into fellowship and all this kind of thing?
Dr. Specker.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, I can. So after medical school, physicians will specialize. And so that might be a three-year program, that might be a four-year program, or longer. So for primary care specialties, typically that's 3 years. Fellowship is a subspecialty, so beyond residency. And the Addiction Medicine Fellowship is a 12-month program beyond residency. And it is now a medical specialty, and there is a board certification under the American Board of Preventive Medicine as a subspecialty. So there's a board exam, there's credentialing for it.
Well, Madam Chair, as a follow-up, we have a program at the U, right, that is training medical people, physicians, and so on. I mean, the cost for – it's a very small cost, so, I mean, I don't want to debate, that it's too much or anything, but wouldn't the cost of creating a fellowship then just sort of follow, and it would be part of the U's budget and so on?
Dr. Specker.
Madam Chair and Representative, the education funds come through, get channeled through the federal government, through CMS funds. So that is how all of the education slots, the residents are funded from the federal government. There aren't any funds for fellows, so they are all used for the residents. So subspecialties do not receive funding from mm-hmm. those dollars. Other states may do it differently. So there might other be health systems that have funding or that do funding for training programs. But in Minnesota, that's the funding mechanism.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Cagle, would you like to make any closing remarks?
I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill. And, you know, through this work, I've learned a lot about what it's going to take for us to combat this opioid epidemic. And this is just, like I said, this is just one small step that we can take that could have an immediate impact to get addiction medicine specialists out into our communities and really help, you know, save people's lives through recovery and treatment. So thank you to these guys who do the work.
Thank you.
So seeing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 3089 be laid over for further consideration. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion carries. The meeting is adjourned.